Chapter 5. Before the autumn was at an end, and while the brown leaves still stood thick on the beeches in our park, my brother and Bertha were engaged to each other, and it was understood that their marriage was to take place early in the next spring. In spite of the certainty I had felt from that moment on the bridge at Prague, that Bertha would one day be my wife, my constitutional timidity and distrust had continued to benumb me, and the words in which I had sometimes premeditated a confession of my love had died away unuttered. The same conflict had gone on within me, as before the longing for an assurance of love from Bertha's lips, the dread lest a word of contempt and denial should fall upon me like a corrosive acid. What was the conviction of a distant necessity to me? L trembled under a present glance, I hungered after a present joy, I was clogged and chilled by a present fear. And so the days passed on. I witnessed Bertha's engagement and heard her marriage discussed, as if I were under a conscious nightmare, knowing it was a dream that would vanish, but feeling stifled under the grasp of hard clutching fingers. When I was not in Bertha's presence, and I was with her very often, for she continued to treat me with a playful patronage that wakened no jealousy in my brother, I spent my time chiefly in wandering, in strolling, or taking long rides, while the daylight lasted, and then shutting myself up with my unread books, for books had lost the power of chaining my attention. My self-consciousness was heightened to that pitch of intensity in which our own emotions take the form of a drama which urges itself imperatively on our contemplation, and we begin to weep, less under the sense of our suffering than at the thought of it. I felt a sort of pitying anguish over the pathos of my own lot, the lot of a being finely organized for pain, but with hardly any fibers, that responded to pleasure, to whom the idea of future evil robbed the present of its joy, and for whom the idea of future good did not still the uneasiness of a present yearning, or a present dread. I went dumbly through that stage of the poet's suffering, in which he feels the delicious pang of utterance, and makes an image of his sorrows. I was left entirely without remonstrance concerning this dreamy wayward life. I knew my father's thought about me. That lad will never be good for anything in life. He may waste his years in an insignificant way on the income that falls to him. I shall not trouble myself about a career for him. One mild morning in the beginning of November, it happened that I was standing outside the portico patting lazy old Caesar, a Newfoundland almost blind with age, the only dog that ever took any notice of me, for the very dogs shunned me, and fawned on the happier people about me, when the groom brought up my brother's horse which was to carry him to the hunt, and my brother himself appeared at the door, florid, broad-chested, and self-complacent, feeling what a good-natured fellow he was not to behave insolently to us all on the strength of his great advantages. "Latimer, old boy," he said to me in a tone of compassionate cordiality, "what a pity it is you don't have a run with the hounds now and then. The finest thing in the world for low spirits." Low spirits, I thought bitterly, as he rode away. That is the sort of phrase with which coarse, narrow natures like yours think to describe experience, of which you can know no more than your horse knows. It is to such as you that the good of this world falls. Ready dullness, healthy selfishness, good-tempered conceit, these are the keys to happiness. The quick thought came that my selfishness was even stronger than his. It was only a suffering selfishness instead of an enjoying one. But then, again, my exasperating insight into Alfred's self-complacent soul, his freedom from all the doubts and fears, the unsatisfied yearnings, the exquisite tortures of sensitiveness, that had made the web of my life, seemed to absolve me from all bonds towards him. This man needed no pity, no love. Those fine influences would have been as little felt by him as the delicate white mist is felt by the rocket caresses. There was no evil in store for him. If he was not to marry Bertha, it would be because he had found a lot pleasanter to himself. Mr. Fillmore's house lay not more than half a mile beyond our own gates, and whenever I knew my brother was gone in another direction, I went there for the chance of finding Bertha at home. Later on in the day I walked thither. By a rare accident she was alone, and we walked out in the grounds together, for she seldom went on foot beyond the trimly swept gravel walks. I remember what a beautiful sylph she looked to me as the low November sun shone on her blonde hair, and she tripped along teasing me with her usual light banter, to which I listened half fondly, half moodily. It was all the sign Bertha's mysterious inner self ever made to me. Today, perhaps, the moodiness predominated, for I had not yet shaken off the excess of jealous hate which my brother had raised in me by his parting patronage. Suddenly I interrupted and startled her by saying, almost fiercely, "Bertha, how can you love Alfred?" She looked at me with surprise for a moment, but soon her light smile came again, and she answered sarcastically, "Why do you suppose I love him? How can you ask that, Bertha?" "What? Your wisdom thinks I must love the man I'm going to marry? The most unpleasant thing in the world. I should quarrel with him. I should be jealous of him. Our marriage would be conducted in a very ill-bred manner. A little quiet contempt contributes greatly to the elegance of life. Bertha, that is not your real feeling. Why do you delight in trying to deceive me by inventing such cynical speeches? I need never take the trouble of invention in order to deceive you, my small tasso." That was the mocking name she usually gave me. The easiest way to deceive a poet is to tell him the truth. She was testing the validity of her epigram in a daring way, and for a moment the shadow of my vision, the Bertha whose soul was no secret to me, passed between me and the radiant girl, the playful sylph whose feelings were a fascinating mystery. I suppose I must have shuddered, or betrayed in some other way my momentary chill of horror. "Tasso," she said, seizing my wrist and peeping round into my face, "are you really beginning to discern what a heartless girl I am? Why, you are not half the poet I thought you were. You are actually capable of believing the truth about me." The shadow passed from between us, and was no longer the object nearest to me. The girl whose light fingers grasped me, whose elfish charming face looked into mine, who, I thought, was betraying an interest in my feelings that she would not have directly avowed, this warm breathing presence again possessed my senses and imagination like a returning siren melody which had been overpowered for an instant by the roar of threatening waves. It was a moment as delicious to me as the waking up to a consciousness of youth after a dream of middle age. I forgot everything but my passion, and said with swimming eyes, "Bertha, shall you love me, when we are first married? I wouldn't mind, if you really loved me only for a little while." Her look of astonishment, as she loosed my hand and started away from me, recalled me to a sense of my strange, my criminal indiscretion. "Forgive me," I said, hurriedly, as soon as I could speak again. I did not know what I was saying. "Ah, Tasso's mad fit has come on, I see," she answered quietly, for as he had recovered herself sooner than I had. "Let him go home and keep his head cool. I must go in, for the sun is setting." I left her full of indignation against myself. I had let slip words which, if she reflected on them, might rouse in her a suspicion of my abnormal mental condition, a suspicion which of all things I dreaded. And besides that, I was ashamed of the apparent baseness I had committed in uttering them to my brother's betrothed wife. I wandered home slowly, entering our park through a private gate instead of by the lodges. As I approached the house, I saw a man dashing off at full speed from the stable yard across the park. Had any accident happened at home? No. Perhaps it was only one of my father's peremptory business errands that required this headlong haste. Nevertheless, I quickened my pace without any distinct motive, and was soon at the house. I will not dwell on the scene I found there. My brother was dead, had been pitched from his horse, and killed on the spot by a concussion of the brain. I went up to the room where he lay, and where my father was seated beside him with a look of rigid despair. I had shunned my father more than anyone since our return home, for the radical antipathy between our natures, made my insight into his inner self a constant affliction to me. But now, as I went up to him, and stood beside him in sad silence, I felt the presence of a new element, that blended us as we had never been blent before. My father had been one of the most successful men in the money-getting world. He had had no sentimental sufferings, no illness. The heaviest trouble that had befallen him was the death of his first wife. But he married my mother soon after, and I remember he seemed exactly the same, to my keen childish observation, the week after her death as before. But now, at last, a sorrow had come, the sorrow of old age, which suffers the more from the crushing of its pride and its hopes, in proportion as the pride and hope are narrow and prosaic. His son was to have been married soon, would probably have stood for the borough at the next election. That son's existence was the best motive that could be alleged for making new purchases of land every year, to round off the estate. It is a dreary thing on to live on doing the same things year after year, without knowing why we do them. Perhaps the tragedy of disappointed youth and passion is less piteous than the tragedy of disappointed age and worldliness. As I saw into the desolation of my father's heart, I felt a movement of deep pity towards him, which was the beginning of a new affection, an affection that grew and strengthened in spite of the strange bitterness with which he regarded me in the first month or two after my brother's death. If it had not been for the softening influence of my compassion for him, the first deep compassion I had ever felt, I should have been stung by the perception that my father transferred the inheritance of an eldest son to me with a mortified sense that fate had compelled him to the unwelcome course of caring for me as an important being. It was only in spite of himself that he began to think of me with anxious regard. There is hardly any neglected child for whom death has made vacant a more favored place, who will not understand what I mean. Gradually, however, my new deference to his wishes, the effect of that patience which was born of my pity for him, won upon his affection, and he began to please himself with the endeavor to make me fill any brother's place as fully as my feebler personality would admit. I saw that the prospect which by and by presented itself of my becoming Bertha's husband, and was welcome to him, and he even contemplated in my case, what he had not intended in my brother's, that his son and daughter-in-law should make one household with him. My softened feelings towards my father made this the happiest time I had known since childhood. These last months in which I retained the delicious illusion of loving Bertha, of longing and doubting and hoping that she might love me. She behaved with a certain new consciousness and distance towards me after my brother's death, and I too was under a double constraint, that of delicacy towards my brother's memory, and of anxiety as to the impression my abrupt words had left on her mind. But the additional screen this mutual reserve erected between us only brought me more completely under her power. No matter how empty the adytum, so that the veil be thick enough. So absolute is our soul's need of something hidden, and uncertain for the maintenance of that doubt and hope and effort which are the breath of its life, that if the whole future were laid bare to us beyond today, the interest of all mankind would be bent on the hours that lie between. We should pant after the uncertainties of our one morning and our one afternoon. We should rush fiercely to the exchange for our last possibility of speculation, of success, of disappointment. We should have a glut of political prophets foretelling a crisis, or a no crisis within the only 24 hours left open to prophecy. Conceive the condition of the human mind, if all propositions whatsoever were self-evident except one, which was to become self-evident at the close of a summer's day, but in the meantime might be the subject of question, of hypothesis, of debate. Art and philosophy, literature, and science would fasten like bees on that one proposition which had the honey of probability in it, and be the more eager, because their enjoyment would end with sunset. Our impulses, our spiritual activities, no more adjust themselves to the idea of their future nullity than the beating of our heart, or the irritability of our muscles. Bertha, the slim, fair-haired girl, whose present thoughts and emotions were an enigma to me amidst the fatiguing obviousness of the other minds around me, was as absorbing to me as a single unknown today as a single hypothetic proposition, to remain problematic till sunset, and all the cramped, hemmed-in belief and disbelief, trust and distrust, of my nature, welled out in this one narrow channel. And she made me believe that she loved me. Without ever quitting her tone of badinage and playful superiority, she intoxicated me with the sense that I was necessary to her, that she was never at ease unless I was near her, submitting to her playful tyranny. It costs a woman so little effort to beset us in this way. A half-repressed word, a moment's unexpected silence, even an easy fit of petulance on our account, will serve us as hashish for a long while. Out of the subtlest web of scarcely perceptible signs, she set me weaving the fancy that S.E. had always unconsciously loved me better than Alfred, but that, with the ignorant, fluttered sensibility of a young girl, S.E. had been imposed on by the charm that lay for her in the distinction of being admired and chosen by a man who made so brilliant a figure in the world as my brother. She satirized herself in a very graceful way for her vanity and ambition. What was it to me that I had the light of my wretched provision on the fact that now it was I who possessed at least all but the personal part of my brother's advantages? Our sweet illusions are half of them conscious illusions, like effects of color that we know to be made up of tinsel, broken glass, and rags. We were married 18 months after Alfred's death, one cold, clear morning in April, when there came hail and sunshine both together, and Bertha, in her white silk and pale green leaves, and the pale hues of her hair and face, looked like the spirit of the morning. My father was happier than he had thought of being again. My marriage, he felt sure, would complete the desirable modification of my character, and make me practical and worldly enough to take my place in society among sane men. For he delighted in Bertha's tact and acuteness, and felt sure she would be mistress of me, and make me what she chose. I was only 21, and madly in love with her. Poor father! He kept that hope a little while after our first year of marriage, and it was not quite extinct when paralysis came and saved him from utter disappointment. I shall hurry through the rest of my story, not dwelling so much as I have hitherto done on my inward experience. When people are well known to each other, they talk rather of what befalls them externally, leaving their feelings and sentiments to be inferred. We lived in a round of visits for some time after our return home, giving splendid dinner parties, and making a sensation in our neighborhood by the new luster of our equipage, for my father had reserved this display of his increased wealth for the period of his son's marriage, and we gave our acquaintances liberal opportunity for remarking that it was a pity I made so poor a figure as an heir and a bridegroom. The nervous fatigue of this existence, the insincerities and platitudes which I had to live through twice over through my inner and outward sense would have been maddening. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.